From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy
Our connection this hour was made on November 2nd, 1983, when President Ronald Reagan signed into existence Martin Luther King Jr. Day. One of the key players campaigning for that national holiday was Stevie Wonder. In his song that you're hearing right now, Happy Birthday, Wonder proposes that the holiday would help realize Dr. King's dreams of equality, love, and unity. The song and the efforts are examples of how music has impacted social change, and you can learn more about it in a course at St. John Fisher College called Music, Persuasion, and Social Change, taught by Professor Aaron Rosell. In fact, you can learn about a lot of fun, interesting, or unusual topics in courses taught at colleges across our area. This hour, we're talking about the classes we wish we could have taken, or maybe those that we did. Maybe they were about silent film history with a live piano accompaniment, or maybe they were wine and beer appreciation classes. School is back in session in just a few weeks, but this hour, we're going back to class a bit early to learn about some of the most interesting classes being taught in our area. Joining me in studio today are three local professors who are sharing their interesting classes with us. Tom Devaney is an associate professor of history at the University of Rochester. He's teaching a class on witchcraft and witch hunts. Welcome to you, Tom.
Thank you.
Also joining us in studio is Margaret Kaminsky. She's the chair of the Chemistry and Geosciences Department at Monroe Community College, and she has taught a class called The Chemistry of Indulgence. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Also joining us, Beth McCoy. She's a distinguished teaching professor of English at SUNY Geneseo, and she is teaching a class on something, a trilogy that I was not familiar with before chatting with her over email, and that is the Broken Earth Trilogy. Tell us a little bit about that, Professor McCoy.
Yeah, thank you, Megan. It's a trilogy by the fantasy writer N.K. Jemisin, who, if you don't know, if she's not a household name yet, she will be very soon. So, and she in part developed the trilogy after hiking the shield volcano Kilauea.
Well, we are going to hear a lot more about that this hour, and we'll also hear about the classes that you listeners have wished you have taken or those that you did take, so you can call the program and share those with us, 844-295-TALK, that's 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email the program at connections@wxxi.org, and you can find me on Twitter, lots of tweets coming in already, and it's at MMacMedia. So we'll get started. I want to say we do the show on occasion because we hear so much from people in the community about interesting classes they've taken. And I would like to start with each of you and just say, what's a class that stood out when you were in high school or college that maybe pushed you in the direction of doing something interesting yourself, or just a class that you thought, wow, I can't believe I had the opportunity to take this? We'll start with you, Tom.
Sure. I think I went to Catholic high school in New York City. And senior year, we were allowed to take a lot of electives. And so I took a course on C.S. Lewis and the various books he had written in the social context of those books. And I guess that started me on thinking about culture and society and how they're all fitting together.
Was that an unusual class for your school to offer in the context of everything else? When you saw it, were you like, I have to take this class? Or was it a requirement that you fell in love with?
It wasn't a requirement. It was a choice. It was the first time that class had ever been taught, and I had read all the Narnia books as a kid and jumped at the chance.
So you're a big Narnia fan. Are you still a Narnia fan?
Yeah, now with my kids. They're reading them as well.
When you approach designing your own curricula, do you try to channel the energy that you had when you were taking that class into what you're doing now, and how do you do that, if the answer's yes?
I do. What I try to do whenever I'm putting together a new course is to make it fun and exciting and interesting for the students. We learn so much better when we're into the topic, and I try to organize most of my courses around individual people and their stories. So rather than talking about history in terms of abstractions or, you know, the French did something, to look at real people and real lives and to really put a human face on it all.
I love that. We open every show, every connection show, with a story because that helps connect people. Pardon the pun, everyone. You're stuck with me for a couple days, so until heaven's back. So that's so important. How do your students react to that approach?
Well, I hope they enjoy it as well.
If you are one of Tom's students, call 844-295-8255. You can review him right here on the air.
What I do hear from quite a number of students, especially those who are taking their first history class at the college level, is that they never thought of history as being in this kind of way. It's quite different than what many of them have experienced in high school. You know, I approach my subject as an open debate. And so, for example, in the witchcraft class, I don't tell them why witch hunting happened during this period. But we explore many different proposals, and I really try to push them to think about why things happened and to make sense of the evidence in front of them. And so it's really more of a conversational kind of approach rather than me telling them what happened and what it means. They're figuring it out themselves.
That's great. We'll dive more into your course throughout the hour, and we'll get a mini lesson today from Tom Devaney from the University of Rochester. Margaret, what was a class that inspired you or that you found unusual or fun when you were going through high school or college?
When I was an undergraduate at Lehigh University, I took two English classes that I didn't have to take. One was detective fiction, and the other one was science fiction. What I liked about both of them, honestly, was a total break from the math and science heavy curriculum that I took. But I also found that I learned a lot about writing. I learned a lot about people. I had thoughts I had never thought before. And in addition, in both of the classes, the professors provided reading lists. And I kept those reading lists, honestly, for decades. And when I needed something new to read, I would look back at the list and pick something, pick an author, read all their books, and think about how had they changed over time, how did other authors influence them, and so on. So those were a lot of fun to take.
What were some of the books on that list?
I would have trouble thinking of the individual books, but authors, I know I read a lot of Marjorie Allingham for the detective fiction, Ursula Le Guin on the science fiction end of things. Definitely a lot of Dorothy Sayers on the detective fiction, and greatly enjoyed those authors and still go back and reread the books every so often.
What was your major in college?
Environmental science.
Okay, so this was really very different. Complete
definitely.
End of the spectrum.
No labs, for instance.
No labs. The research shows that taking classes outside of your major helps your brain work in different ways, right side, left side. Going back, would you have wanted to take more classes outside of your major? I don't know what your the setup looked like at Lehigh University, but do you regret not exploring more of that?
I actually feel very good about the amount I was able to explore. I had come in with some advanced credits, but didn't want to graduate early, so I had time to take a music class. I had time to take a couple of philosophy classes and a couple of religion classes, and many of my classmates weren't able to do that, especially in fields like engineering. The curriculum is so prescribed that they have almost no electives. And I'm so glad that I did have the opportunity to explore outside of my major.
Mm-hmm. Beth, what kind of classes did you explore outside of your major, which I'm assuming was probably English, but maybe I'm wrong.
As an undergraduate, I was an English major with a journalism concentration, a Spanish minor, and a political science major. So everything in some way was outside of my major.
What's a class that stood out to you?
When I first started graduate school at the same place I went to undergrad, I realized that there was so much that I had not read. And I was lucky enough that at the University of Delaware, the renowned poet Sonia Sanchez had come down from Temple University to teach a class. And it was a cross-listed graduate, undergraduate class populated by lots of engineering majors. And she just kept putting works of literature up on the board that we could not believe we had never heard of. From W.E.B. Du Bois's Souls of Black Folk to Margaret Walker's Jubilee. And I frantically wrote down every single work of literature that she had mentioned. And as I went through my graduate program and all the prescribed classes, I had this other kind of stealth program that changed my life, changed the course of my life.
I look back on my college experience, and I took courses with writers like Mary Gaitskill and George Saunders, and in my 19-year-old brain, I wasn't really appreciating how much I should appreciate that. And I look back now, and fortunately, they've been willing to engage me in my wiser years. But I thought, what a great experience. And sometimes you don't know what you're missing until you're beyond that experience and you can reflect on how great it was. So I'm glad that all of you have had excellent, awesome classes in your past that are now contributing to what you're doing now. We'll delve into your courses in just a minute. We're already getting a lot of phone calls and emails, so we'll take our first phone call. This is Mildred in Rochester. Go ahead, Mildred.
Wow, yippee, first. Okay, now, this is really interesting because most of us don't really think about the things that impacted us for the better. We're always thinking about the things that impacted us in any way for the negative, but never for the better. Okay, I just want to zip through this because I want to make sure I get it all in. Number one, I graduated from high school. I graduated from St. Benedict Academy in Erie, Pennsylvania. And back in the dark ages when you had to take 2 years of a language, foreign language, before you could attend college, I took 2 years of Spanish, and then the only other person that wanted to take that third year of Spanish with me begged me to take Spanish with Miss Calista, Miss Rebecca Calista, who I can remember doing an essay on Gustavo Adolfo Bécquer, a Spanish writer, poet, and I can still remember her. I don't have the essay anymore, but I can remember her writing on it. I can tell you found a friend in Bécquer, and I was just like, oh my gosh. You know, you don't really get a lot of affirmation about how fab you are, but now I know I am fabulous. Now, and the other thing is, several years later, when I was merely in quotation marks, a college dropout, because I just didn't see any point to college, which is, my views have changed, but I was working retail at the time, and I ran into Miss Calista at a department store in Erie, and something else that flattered me is that she didn't remember me as being a high school student. She thought I was one of the college students that she knew when she was attending college. And I can still remember how flattered I was that, oh, she thought I was from her college experience. How cool. Now, the second thing is, years later, I was certifiably qualified to be a student. No, yeah, to be a student in a program for underemployed people. And this was at Mercyhurst College, also in Erie. And they wanted me to take a reading literacy class. And I kind of went to the people in charge of the program and said, not that there's anything wrong with that, but I'm already a great reader. No offense, but I think I'm already a great reader, a fine reader. And I'd like to be able to take a different class. Can we look at what might be available? They permitted me to take a class in world literature. And, oh, man, the instructor at the time at Mercyhurst was Dr. Marilyn Jewell. And I can remember taking this class with her. We discussed the Iliad and the Aeneid and all this stuff that I'd only read about and read of, because nobody in my family read this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. You know?
That's
so
great.
Those were two great experiences in the people that impacted my college / college in quotation marks experience, but also post-college. Mm-hmm. And even now, they both of these experiences and remembrances caused me to stand up a little straighter. And I just wanted to let you guys realize that you have impact that truly can't be measured. Can't be measured.
Thank you, Mildred. Thank you for sharing
Absolutely.
All that. We appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
That's such an important point. How many of you remembered teachers from high school or college or even before that that you think, oh, I'm so glad I had that teacher and I remember what we talked about in this class? You're nodding, Beth. Mm-hmm. Is there someone that stands out to you, one teacher that...
There was a Spanish teacher named Ray Camiscioli in New Jersey who kept telling us over and over, someday you will be traveling, someday you will be traveling. And none of us believed him, and it was the best prediction in the world.
I love that. Margaret, anyone stand out to you?
I'm actually thinking of my eighth grade physical science teacher, Mr. Moore. I have no idea what his first name is, but what I remember about that class was it was really one of the first times I was challenged to think and to use evidence and set up experiments. I remember the big experiment at the end of the year, the sludge test, where you were given a cup of a mixture. It had liquids, it had solids, it had color, and you had to use all of the techniques you had learned during the course to separate the mixture and then identify all of its components. And we would come in during class, we'd come in after school. It was just so much fun to be there experimenting and to be relatively independent in doing it.
What grade was that?
Eighth grade.
Wow. Yeah. Shout out to Mr. Moore.
Yes.
Mr. Moore. Very good. How about you, Tom?
Well, I've had a lot of professors and teachers who've had a big effect on me, and certainly my graduate school advisors. But I think one person that stands out, because it was a critical moment, when I was a freshman in college, I was doing a kind of odd program of being pre-med while also studying history. And Martha Risser was an archaeology professor with whom I took, I think, three courses that first year, and really pushed me to go into the one direction rather than the other. And she did that by, as I've said before, by bringing things to life, by making the ancient world seem really really tangible and real, and not just something that was so far away, but something we could really understand.
Well, let's talk witches with you, Tom. Let's bring witches to life. We're talking about fun classes you wish you would have taken or classes you have taken. We have three local professors in here sharing their classes with us. And the first one up is Witchcraft and Witch Hunts 1400 through 1800. That's offered at the University of Rochester with Professor Devaney. Why did you want to teach a class on witches and witch hunts, Tom?
Well, my own research focuses on questions of tolerance and community building, and I've done that particularly in relation to interfaith relations between Christians and Muslims and Jews. I think many of us know that course enrollments in the humanities have been a challenge for several years, and so I wanted to create a course that would really bring students in, and when once they're in the history classroom, quite a lot of them end up staying there and taking more and more classes. So a big part of it was just to simply come up with something that would appeal to a wide cross range of students.
So do you think, and maybe this is a question for all of you, do we need these kind of sexy courses to bring students in? Is that a technique that colleges are now using to attract more students, or do they not have to really worry about that? I would take your class if I were at U of R. I would take all of these classes. That's why I've asked you to come in. And I was an Italian and television major in college, so I would not be looking at these types of things, but they sound cool. So is this a tactic, Margaret?
I think it is. I was talking with the other professors before the show, the class Chemistry of Indulgence at MCC, its previous incarnation was called Contemporary Consumer Chemistry, where it attracted, well, not many people as time went on. Lydia Tien put in the work to recast the course as the Chemistry of Indulgence, still a way to help students understand some general chemical principles and how to do science, but in a more interesting way, because all of the activities are around food, and who doesn't like food in some form or another. And so students have to take at least a science course in general, whatever program they're in. And so you need a way to make the science class sound like something that would be interesting and that wouldn't be so hard that they couldn't do it or use math that they'd never learned. And Chemistry of Indulgence fits that bill. And in fact, over the years, we've gone from one section to two sections a semester to three this semester, including at the Brighton campus and a section at the downtown campus. And in fact, when they built the new downtown campus across the street, they put in a flex lab, which they actually gave us a real stove and a real refrigerator and sinks. And the classroom is used for many other things as well, but it's perfect for our Chemistry of Indulgence.
That's great.
Yeah.
So Tom, if we're sitting in your classroom, you've drawn me in with your witches, your Witchcraft and Witch Hunts course title. What am I learning in your class? What are some of the stories that you're sharing?
We're looking at a lot of individual case studies. So for instance, we go through the complete trial record of a woman named Temple Annika, who lived in the German city of Braunschweig in the 17th century. We hear about the accusations that were made against her. We read the transcripts of interrogations. We read the letters that the interrogators and the city councilors were sending to each other and to other experts. And we're experiencing almost alongside her the psychological trauma and pain that led her by the end of the trial to confess to being a witch and to have signed a pact with the devil. To give another example, we're looking at the story of Anne Gunther, whose father seems to have been quite a jerk. He didn't get along with anybody, and to settle a score with a neighbor, he forced her to pretend to have been afflicted with curses from the neighbor. So stories like that, but we're also putting this in the wider context of all the different events that were going on in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries. The Reformation, changing attitudes toward women, the rise of proto-capitalist economies, the centralization of government, and so on and on and on.
Why were witch hunts and why were, you know, pursuing so-called witches so appealing to many people during that time? Why was that a thing that happened?
Well, that would take probably a semester to really go through. But I think one of the answers we look at is the idea that having an enemy like witches really affirms people's sense of who they are and belongingness. So it gives a sense to the unfortunate things that are happening in people's lives. So, for instance, somebody's cow dies and they're going to really struggle to eat during the winter. But they can feel better if they know that the cow died because somebody put a curse on the cow. And that person was told by the devil to put a curse on the cow. And the devil's doing that because I am a good person and a good Christian. So it gives that kind of sense to things.
Do you find that in the conversations you're having with your students, you're drawing parallels between what's happening or what was happening in the 1400s through the 1800s and what we're looking at now in contemporary society? Do you stay in the past, or do you have conversations about parallels?
Those parallels certainly come up. We take a rather cautious approach in simply taking a model from the past and saying, well, this is the same thing that's happening now. As has been often said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. So I think there are a lot of parallels that one can see in terms of seeing an invisible enemy within one's own society, an enemy that looks like everybody else. And so in early Christianity, it was pagans, and then it was heretics, and then it was witches. And in the 20th century, it was anarchists, communists, terrorists, the list goes on. So we look at these parallels, but we also try to place each of the situations within its own times and context and how ideas were moving around.
And what do you hope your students take away at the end of the semester?
I think in this, as in most humanities classes, it's about learning skills, it's about the content, and it's about hopefully making the students ultimately into better, more thoughtful people. So they learn about early modern history through this lens of witchcraft. They also learn how to think critically. They learn how to take different interpretations of the witch hunts and weigh them against each other and figure out which ones make sense and which ones don't. And then ultimately, this is a course about how societies can turn on their own members and how things can go horribly wrong. But we don't believe in witches and we don't persecute witches anymore. So there's also a hopeful ending to the story that ultimately the message of skepticism about magic got through. And I think that's something for students who are concerned about events in our own times. It's a message that activism and skepticism and making their voices heard can matter.
What kind of work do the students do? Is it mostly reading, or do they do projects where are they interpreting anything? How hands-on is the course? I'm just envisioning experiences that I've had where we've taken on a reading and we've tried to understand where, you know, this person accused of being a witch was coming from, like you said, understanding that psychological aspect. Are they really delving into that human part of it as well, or are they reading the history? What does it look like? If I were to sign up, what kind of work would I be doing?
There are a variety of different things, especially in the early part of the semester. I do a good bit of the talking, giving students the background knowledge. But we also have a lot of discussion. We have debates in the classroom. And then their final project is a case study. It's kind of odd, but Western New York is a really good place to study witchcraft. At the University of Rochester, we have the Russell Hope Robbins Library.
Robbins Library, yes.
The Robbins Library. And in the back of that library, behind a locked door and a staircase, are a couple of file cabinets, which have Professor Robin's own notes from the 1950s when he was writing a dictionary of demonology and witchcraft. And so they can go pore through those mimeographed notes and transcripts of individual trials. At Cornell, there's another treasure trove of materials. Cornell has probably the best collection of witchcraft material in the country. Wow. So they can get really hands-on and get the feel of really doing history. And since the project is a case study, that doing history is focused on an individual person.
Is that something, I saw you nodding, Beth. I know you have a lot to say about the humanities and how students can be involved in the humanities in more hands-on ways, more collaborative ways. Did you identify with anything Tom said in that respect? Are you worried about the future of the humanities?
I think I'm kind of speechless about the question, simply because I can't predict where things are going to go from here. I think we've all heard the worries, but I would also say that we hear the same worries about the sciences, right? Casting doubt on scientific method, casting doubt on scientific knowledge. And so increasingly in my humanities, my literature classes, I've been trying to do what many people will call the both and, trying to set the humanities and the sciences in conversation with each other, as of course they've always been. Descartes couldn't talk about the scientific method without relying on metaphor and story. And so I think that a lot of us are trying to figure our way out of this particular cultural moment and trying to both emphasize the importance of our own particular disciplinary expertise and also not get lured into devaluing any other discipline.
Mm-hmm. Margaret, would you like to add anything to that as the representative of the sciences in the room?
I think that that's a very valid point. Even if you go into the elementary schools, for a while the talk was all STEM, science, mm-hmm. technology, engineering, and math. And now in many elementary schools, the talk is STEAM, adding the arts into mm-hmm. that. And I do believe that the disciplines inform one another. We're all using some of the same things, like using evidence to support mm-hmm. what we say. Mm-hmm. The types of evidence are different, but the grounding of it is we don't just say stuff. We support what we say with evidence. And that's important in all fields.
Before we take our short break, and when we come back, we'll hear about Professor McCoy and Professor Kaminsky's classes. I'd like to say, just because we've invited professors from local colleges and universities doesn't mean, if you're not a student at one of those, you can't take classes in our community. You can audit classes at colleges and universities, many ways to find them. You can also go to somewhere like Osier or the Rochester Brainery where they're offering classes. This is an email from a student named Sue. She says, as an older student, I recently took a class at Osier at RIT on the history of toilet paper. I think a class in the evolution of plumbing would be fascinating. So thank you for that, Sue. So we'll take our short break. When we come back, more on the classes you wish you would have taken. I'm seeing a lot of feedback pouring in. You can email us, connections@wxxi.org. Call the program 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Short break, more Connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Wednesday on The Next Connections, the Walt Disney Company recently announced the casting for its new film, The Jungle Cruise, and the lead actor set to play the company's first openly gay character is a straight man. Critics are blasting Disney for not hiring a gay actor. Meanwhile, other people are pushing back against the critics, saying actors are actors. We'll be joined by local LGBTQ actors who will weigh in on the issue. Talk to you Wednesday. You are listening to Connections this hour. We are talking about fun and interesting classes, maybe unusual classes you wish you would have taken. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. I'm joined by Tom Devaney, Associate Professor of History at the University of Rochester, Margaret Kaminsky, the Chair of the Chemistry and Geosciences Department at MCC, and Beth McCoy, Distinguished Teaching Professor of English at SUNY Geneseo. And we're turning now to Professor Kaminsky's class, which is called The Chemistry of Indulgence. You heard a little bit about that earlier. And Professor Kaminsky, why did you decide to teach a class on the chemistry of indulgence?
It sounds like fun, and everything is organized around food, and who doesn't like food? the class was actually developed by Lydia Tien and was first taught at the Brighton campus. I was teaching at the downtown campus and wanted to bring more variety to the course offerings at the downtown campus. And I thought that would be a perfect class for the students there. It took a couple semesters to get it going. And in fact, one way that I promoted the course was to go into classes that my colleagues taught and do a sample activity. The sample activity involved making an emulsion from chocolate and lemonade and then eating the results. And that did get me enough students to get the class off the ground. And then in future semesters, when we made liquid nitrogen ice cream as our midterm review, that could involve reviewing states of matter, types of matter, changes of phase, and so on. But it also generally produced a little bit of extra liquid nitrogen ice cream, and I could go out in the hallways and offer it. And people would say, oh, that class sounds really great. And I would tell them, here's the time. Sign up for it. It's a 3-credit natural science, and was able to build the class that way. So I think really what attracted me to it was a course that was accessible to the general education student who did not necessarily love science or love math, but nevertheless, I could meet them where they were and help them learn some science. And one of my favorite parts of the course actually is the student projects. And two of my favorite projects that I recall students doing, one woman had grandma's recipe for cloud cookies. And grandma was gone now, and she could never replicate grandma's cloud cookies. They just didn't come out correctly. So that's what she based her project on. How can I improve my version of grandma's cloud cookies? And we had a little book we were using. I'm blanking on the name right now, but it's out of the Exploratorium. And it had a chapter on eggs, and it explained how if you're trying to whip egg whites and there's any trace of fat, it will break the emulsion. They're not going to whip up. And if you ever tried to whip egg whites in plastic, there is always fat. No matter how clean you think that bowl is, there are traces of fat. And she realized that's, in fact, what she had been doing when she tried to make grandma's cloud cookies. So she tried it with a metal bowl. Lo and behold, it worked. She had asked a question, as scientists do. She had come up with a hypothesis, as scientists do. She had run the experiment, and she came to a conclusion. And she felt like a true scientist. That had never happened for her before. Another interesting project was a student wondered, how do they make pork rinds? And when he brought it up, I wondered that too. I thought it was just like Fritos or something. And it turned out that it involved taking a certain layer of fat from a pig, cutting it into small strips, drying it in the oven so that it would have like a tough outer skin but still be moist in the middle. And then when you throw it in the fryer, the remaining water turns into steam and puffs up the snack, which is in a lot of ways much like popcorn. The water inside a popcorn kernel turns into steam, and when that happens, it expands by about 1,000 times. And so not only did he find out how you make the snack, but he connected it to another activity that we had done. So that's, I think, the satisfaction I get from the course is seeing students who don't think of themselves as scientists, nevertheless doing science in my class.
In an accessible way. I'm just looking at the course learning outcomes that are posted online on the MCC website. Describe the basic concepts of matter, discuss the atomic nature of matter and characteristics of atoms and molecules, use symbols to represent chemical formulas and balance reactions. And there are about 12 different things here, apply aspects of the scientific method. So for students who are not science majors, maybe they feel like they're not, quote unquote, good at science or math, this is an accessible way to help them understand that they can be part of a course that's about science. I really respect that.
Yes. And the kind of fun thing is sometimes you get students who are scientists. They're taking organic chemistry. That's the highest chemistry we offer at MCC. They can get something out of this class, too, because they are looking conceptually. And they can make their project anything that they want it to be. So it's, even though it's accessible to non-scientists, it can also expand how a scientist thinks about things as well.
We'll turn to the phones now because I think one of our listeners has a bit of pushback for us. This is Bob in Rochester. Go ahead, Bob.
Hello there.
Hi.
Yeah, the pushback, if you want to call it that, is that we are talking about vocational education rather than education in a true liberal arts sense. I haven't heard the word philosophy mentioned. I haven't heard the word sociology mentioned. I haven't heard the word government mentioned. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you are talking about vocational schools. People say, Joe, I am going to send you to college so that you can learn to be a blank. Well, that's not what college is for. College is for expanding the mind. It is, there's a book that, if you folks haven't all read, written by a professor of political philosophy at Cornell named Alan Bloom, who's probably the leading political philosopher of his day in the 60s, called The Closing of the American Mind. And he talks, among other things, about the fact that we don't take education and give it an opportunity to open the mind, to critically think about thoughts that are irrelevant to the problems that we will solve. You talk about philosophy of religion, ethics. We haven't heard a word about that, and those are the things that are really important. You can learn the trades later. I was a tradesman, if you want to call it that, but that all came later. That all came in graduate school. What came in undergraduate school, and by the way, I was a government major and a chemistry minor, so I'm not suggesting we shouldn't teach some of it. Just as we used to have distribution requirements, which solved the problem of teaching witchcraft as a way to get people to think about history. You can say you must take two history courses. Take a pick. You must take two political philosophy courses. Take a pick. But we need to expand the mind, not expand the economic opportunity. And we've degraded education at most schools to vocational training rather than to academics.
Okay, Bob, stay on the line for us. First of all, I don't understand your comment about vocational training, because we're talking to professors from SUNY Geneseo, the University of Rochester, MCC. Our guest from MCC is a professor in the chemistry and geosciences department. So we're not talking about the trades, which are equally valuable, but the show is about academics.
No. Chemistry is a vocation. Teaching chemistry and I was a chem minor, so teaching chemistry as a major at the loss of teaching the humanities is vocational school.
Okay, that is one
vocation.
Opinion. I'm going to turn to our guests in the studio who are professors, who are academics, and let them respond. So, Margaret, go ahead. Your thoughts.
My question.
Pardon? Okay, go ahead, Margaret.
So, for instance, for chemistry, I would to some extent agree that the sequence of Gen Chem 1, Gen Chem 2, Organic Chem 1, Organic Chem 2 is part of the training for chemists, for chemical engineers, pharmacists, doctors, physician assistants, veterinarians, and so on. The class that I'm talking about is actually designed to not as a vocational course. It's not intended to get somebody a job. I would agree, though, that the focus has narrowed quite a lot. At MCC, for instance, we've gone through a huge curriculum project, and in most majors, students don't have very many free choices left. They need to take choices that will, basically fulfill a SUNY gen ed requirement or an MCC gen ed requirement, and they don't have as much opportunity to explore classes just to expand their thinking, expand their mind, expand their outlook. And I think that's regrettable.
I was going to say, isn't that a horrible shame? Should come out of college or university with their minds expanded. You can learn the rest later.
But
you can teach someone with a good mind anything. You can't teach someone who has learned something to have a good mind.
But Bob, what I don't understand about your argument, and I'll turn to Beth and Tom to help me answer this question next, is how are you not expanding your mind by taking a course on something you know nothing about and that has parallels to other pieces of what you're learning in college or in life. I'll turn to Beth first.
Well, I want to thank the caller for just the hearty advocacy for the liberal arts and the spirit of the liberal arts. And so I really thank you for that. What you probably don't know is that the course that I'm talking about, it's about the writer N.K. Jemisin's Broken Earth trilogy, but the subtitle is Blackness, Justice, and Love, which are essentially philosophical concepts. And so students are going to come away, and I'm going to have my mind stretched, as I endlessly do, including because we're having collaboration with some faculty from the geological sciences who are going to come in and stretch our minds. So I need to be able to be conversant about things like quaternary time or what a torus is. I can't tell you that right now because I'm still practicing those definitions. But I think that we need to be mindful of the both and again. When we work with students, regardless of their age, they all come from places and structures, families, and other institutions that are indeed rightfully worried about the cost of education, that are indeed worried about employment prospects in a world that many people think is becoming increasingly precarious, as the protagonists in the novels that I'm going to teach find. So I would like just to remind us to always think about the both and. The liberal arts are inherently valuable, and they also help us to do things.
I understand that, but how many of you have read or taught the Nicomachean Ethics, the Politics, St. Thomas More?
I have.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Me
at least
too.
One of you.
My
point is, there are great thinkers with great thoughts that make kids, students, whatever, manipulate ideas. They can do the rest later, but they need to expand their minds first.
Okay, Bob. I'll let you jump in just one second, Bob. I want to thank you for your call. I want to thank you for your thoughts because it's generated an interesting discussion. There are many points here that we'll continue to talk about throughout the hour. And the general point I think you're trying to make as well is there's space for everyone. At least that's part of what I'm getting. And I'll let Tom jump in right here.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I totally agree with your position that university should be about expanding the students' minds. And I think that's something that we're all trying to do here. The difficulty is that a lot of students who are 18, 19 years old and have been getting these kind of dire messages about you better make something of yourself, you better do something with your life, you better be practical. So it's our job to kind of ease them into opening up their minds, to really actually open up their minds to new ideas. So if they're coming, you know, if I have a business major or a chemistry major or whatever who's taking the witchcraft class, then what I'm trying to do is get that student's attention and engagement through, you know, the interesting course content. And then in that class, we're reading Augustine, we're reading Thomas Aquinas, we're reading Jean Baudin. So we have to meet the students where they are, and especially in the context of the message that they're getting from a lot of different parts of society right now, in order to do what you're suggesting.
Bob, thank you for your call.
I guess, and I will let you go. I just think we are dealing with different sets of priorities.
Okay, I think that's fair. I think everyone's approaching this. Yeah, I agree with you. I think different people approach this from different places and at different angles. We all do have different priorities. I want to thank you for your call. Thank you for that discussion as well. Thanks, Bob. Before we run out of time, we need to make sure we talk about Conversations, Blackness, Love, and Justice, a course taught by Professor McCoy at SUNY Geneseo. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, I was not familiar with the trilogy, but when I did some research for this program, every news story that I read about it was, this is the next big thing. If you read any science fiction, any fantasy, you have to read this trilogy. Multiple Hugo Awards won by this author. Tell us about the Broken Earth trilogy.
It's kind of hard to sum up, and so I'll do the best that I can. Jemisin imagines a world that may be Earth set way in the future. And so one way of thinking about her is an Afrofuturist author. But it's a world that goes periodically through seasons, seismic disasters, earthquakes, and volcanoes that change everything. And the people who live in this world rely for their safety upon a group of people called Origenes, people who can control these seismic forces. And because they can control and protect other human beings, from these seismic forces, they are resented, feared, and reviled. And Jemison, I'll let folks read more about how she sees this as an allegory for blackness. And she stated she does Reddit Ask Me Anythings, blogs prolifically. So I won't talk too much about that part of the course, but Geneseo is involved in launching its Center for Integrative Learning, and so we really are trying to get not just students but also faculty and staff across the college to, again, value our disciplinary expertise but also reach across disciplinary lines. And so I'm teaching this course as a way to, at a very small scale way, gesture to a larger course that I'll be teaching in the spring on the art of Steve Prince, who is a New Orleans-born and raised visual artist.
How did you decide you wanted to teach this class? What about the trilogy spoke to you and the parallels that you saw? Why did you decide now was the right time to teach this course?
My colleague in English, Alice Rutkowski, recommended the novels for me. And part of it is I thought that it was just an interesting story and a good opportunity to take folks who may be English majors and to have them open their minds, to use Bob's phrase, about the geological sciences and the stories told by the geological sciences. But I think also we were talking about titling courses. I study titles and other forms of books for a living, and I am really rotten at titling courses. And so just trying to think of a way to set Jemison's work, again, you can put Jemison's name in the title, and trying to figure out how to attract students to a course on this has proven to be a challenge. Hmm. And so I can never really, for me, courses always start with the germ of an idea. And the beauty and the magic, the witchcraft, if you may, of embarking on a journey about books that I've read but have never taught is to be able to create alongside the students. And so if I am a little bit hesitant about talking about the course, it's because I'm so happy that it's a new course and I'm going in and I haven't decided anything about the way it's going to go. And we talk a lot about creating structures where students solve problems. And part of one of the problems that I hope we solve is how do we build a conversation about a trilogy where the author brings in so many strands of ideas and philosophies and bodies of knowledge, and how do we actually have a conversation through them?
I think that's so interesting. And you're not only collaborating with other departments, you're having students collaborate with each other. And you mentioned in an email that you sent to me before the program, that's becoming more and more uncommon. We're seeing, let me find your comment here so I don't misquote you. Let's see here. Oh, you want students to become more skilled and practice at working collaboratively. So that's really a priority for you in this course. I know you haven't quite decided about what exactly it looks like yet, but with that final project, will that be collaborative as well? And what do you hope they take away after the course ends?
The books are indeed about how to survive when everything changes. And so it is important for us to be able to work together across disciplinary lines, across lines of personality and preference, across political lines. And so in small scale ways throughout the semester, students will be meeting in small groups and large groups to solve problems. So even if it is about how to, the problem is how to extend the conversation about, let's say, Kilauea, a volcano that has affected thousands of people in a U.S. state, how can we actually extend that, that line of inquiry to, for example, Guatemala, where a much less publicized volcano, the Fuego volcano, had profound impact on the human beings who live in that country.
Well, good luck on your course. I'm going to read this trilogy because I am very intrigued. And listeners, again, if you're not familiar, it's called Broken Earth. Just Google and you will find dozens and dozens of articles and critiques and analysis that I'm glad that you've introduced this to at least me and maybe other people in our audience.
I put it in my notes.
Oh, they're good. It's added to your book list. a couple listener emails and tweets that have been coming in about classes they've taken. This is from Jean. She says, I took a class called Geology of Our National Parks at Edinburgh State in Pennsylvania 20 years ago. It inspired me to travel out west, which I did many times, and provided me with numerous memories. I was fascinated with that class. That's from Jean. Sheila on Twitter says, as a high school English teacher, I hear from my students that a comparative religions class would help them understand world events that involve religious conflict. We heard from Chelsea on Twitter. She took a silent film class that had a live piano accompaniment. That was through the University of Rochester and I believe the George Eastman Museum. Laura on Twitter says, I took a class at Nazareth College in the 90s that compared and contrasted films with the books they were based on. That's really interesting. As an English professor, Beth, how do you feel about books versus the movie?
They both have their virtues.
Diplomatic. Let's see. Oh, so many comments. Kara says she took a class about the Simpsons at RIT, so some fun ones there. Mike says Game of Thrones, an English class at RIT. Lots of television classes. Eileen says U of R teaches a course on religion and comic books in addition to a Speaking Stones class. So many classes there to keep on the look for. Julia, our colleague down the hall, says Japanese drama, one of the finest courses I ever took. Kyle says anything related to Bob Dylan. So we're seeing a span here. And just because we have only a few schools represented on this program doesn't mean you can't find interesting courses at other ones. And to Bob's point earlier, I want to reiterate, everyone has different priorities, but I think the common ground that we found throughout this hour with Bob, with other listeners, is that everyone wants to learn, and we all learn in different ways, and we all have different interests. And wherever you can find them, more power to you. And again, it could be at local colleges, at Osier, at the Rochester Brainery, through talking with people, through listening to this program or other programs. So, space for everyone. I'd like to thank our guests for joining me today. Tom Devaney from the University of Rochester, thanks for being here. Margaret Kaminsky from MCC and Beth McCoy from SUNY Geneseo. Thank you all for sharing your courses. You can find them all online, listeners. Our thanks to Rob Braden, our engineer, Juan Vasquez, and Mike Black helping out on phones today. I'm Megan Mack sitting in for Evan Dawson. We will talk to you tomorrow.